I'm Peter Monaghan, the producer of Poetry on the Radio here on ArtSound FM. We've reached the first anniversary of broadcasting our programme. We've featured conversations with poets from around the ACT and occasionally poets visiting Canberra. To mark our anniversary, I and Poetry on the Radio co-hosts Peter Searles and Kimberly K. Williams thought we might let listeners know how we came to be interested in poetry in the first place. Here's Kimberly K. Williams.
In the late 1990s, American poet Robert Pinsky became the Poet Laureate of the United States, and in his new position, he decided he wanted to work on a substantial project for his two-year tenure. And this project became the Favorite Poem Project, and it culminated in an anthology which he co-edited with Maggie Dietz. At the time, in my life, I had just finished graduate school and I was working at Borders Bookshop, one of the original Borders bookstores in the United States, and I became aware of this project because of my work there. I was also teaching part-time. We were asked to distribute postcards, and this was part of their gathering of the poems. They had 17,000 people nominate a poem, write in a postcard. And on this card, you just nominated your poem, you said who the poet was, and you just briefly explained why this poem meant something to you. Besides wanting to do a substantial project with his tenure as Poet Laureate, he also really wanted to show how many people love poetry, not just poets, not just teachers of poetry, but people from all cross sections. And so that's part of what the anthology does too, is it shows people in many different professions and many different lines of work who enjoy poetry. And so each poem, ultimately out of the 17,000, they picked enough poems to fill an anthology, and they just put them in order, I think, of the poet's name. And each poem has a little introduction from the person who nominated it. And it really became this whole thing. I think ultimately there were three anthologies. It went into the 2000s. There's a video series that you can find online. It really grew. And ultimately it became a format where I turned it into an assignment when I was teaching. And I just love it. I think it was highly successful, and it really speaks to how poetry can enrich our lives no matter what it is we do. So I thought as part of our celebration of our one-year anniversary, we could share our favorite poems with our listeners. The first poem that I chose is the poem that I read when I was, I can tell you exactly where I was when I found this poem. I was in Marwell Bookstore on the Wayne State University campus, and I was probably 17. And I was buying my books for my first semester of university. And I was in the bookstore and I was flipping through this anthology put together by the American poet Donald Hall. And this is Robert Creeley's The Rain. And I had that experience that Emily Dickinson describes where I read this poem and I felt like I had a physical reaction to it. And I realized at that moment, this is what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. This is Robert Creeley's The Rain. All night the sound had come back again, and again falls this quiet, persistent rain. When am I to myself that must be remembered, insisted upon so often? Is it that never the ease, even the hardness of rain falling, will have for me something other than this, something not so insistent? Am I to be locked in this final uneasiness? Love, if you love me, lie next to me, be for me like rain, the getting out of the tiredness, the fatuousness, the semi-lust of intentional indifference. Be wet with a decent happiness.
In this anniversary feature, the other two of us then asked our collaborator why that poem.
Well, you know, as a 17-year-old, I had no idea what the semi-lust of intentional indifference might mean. And it took years. Like, probably I didn't understand that line till I was in my 30s.
What do you think it was about that poem that grabbed you?
Well, what it was for me was that the penultimate stanza, love if you love me, lie next to me, because it seemed like a blessing of sorts. It seemed to understand a kind of love that I think at 17 I I had no idea about, where it allows for humanity, right? It allows for complexity. I didn't understand the word fatuous. I mean, I'd heard it before, but it's, you know, he gets away with a very abstract two lines here with the fatuousness and the semi-lust of intentional indifference, which I don't think I understood those lines until I was in my 30s. But the rain and the persistent thoughtfulness of the poem captured me. And this idea that love could be something other than just romance or just what you see in Hollywood, you know, at 17, that I'm sure TV and movies were my greatest depictions. And this offered an alternative, and it just captured me.
It's interesting that you talk about the parts that only came to make sense later on. So how has your experience or enjoyment of the poem changed after all these years?
I think that is the sign of a good poem, right? Like a good song, it holds up after so many years, a good novel. And you can change with it or it can change with you. I'm not sure which way it goes, but I think it's just now that I get that, right? The tiredness, the fatuousness. These lives we lead are exhausting. And what else can we wish someone but sort of, you know, a decent happiness? I really do think life is so complicated. And so I think I just understand the poem more fully now, and I can be with it, the ending of it. I think at first maybe I related to the first few stanzas more, and now it's the end of the poem that I can be with.
It's interesting that a poem about sort of the complications of life would lead you to, I mean, immediately to set upon a career of delving into how complex things are, rather than to retreat, for example, into some kind of simplicity that's much more available.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I think that's what poetry allows, right? It allows sort of an examination. To me, poetry is like a prism, and you can put life through it in its different iterations, and it will refract in unexpected ways, and maybe it helps bring an understanding then of it, or a way of being in this world a little bit more peacefully. I don't know. The next poem I want to read comes from Louise Gluck's The Wild Iris. This book won the Pulitzer Prize, I think in 1994 maybe. And I'm going to read the final poem of the book. It's a beautiful book of poems, The White Lilies. As a man and a woman make a garden between them like a bed of stars, here they linger in the summer evening, and the evening turns cold with their terror. It could all end. It is capable of devastation. All can be lost. Through scented air, the narrow columns uselessly rising, and beyond, a churning sea of poppies. Hush, beloved. It doesn't matter to me how many summers I live to return. This one summer we have entered eternity. I felt your two hands bury me to release its splendor.
Yeah, to me that straight away just talks to that idea that I've heard before about it's only when you love something or someone that you start to fear death.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I've experienced that too. It awakens this thing in you that you don't want something to end, and you know that everything will.
Mm-hmm.
It just really brings that into focus.
Right. It's almost a primal thing, isn't it? The thing I love about this book, too, is that, and I wrote a paper on this book, so I know it pretty well, is that when a poem is titled with the name of a flower, the white lilies in this case, you know, part of the voice is supposed to be the flower. The book has perennial flowers, which come back year after year, right? And then annual ones, which die. And it becomes this metaphor, sort of what you're talking about. Inevitably, right? Even the perennial ones will have an end. But it is a really interesting way that the book and the poems contemplate our being here.
Do your favorite books like that come back to you almost seasonally? Your copy looks like you've taken it through some kind of storm.
The funny thing is that I have two copies of this book and they look exactly alike. Yeah, I mean, I probably have had this book since I bought it for the paper.
Was that particular poem always one that jumped out to you in particular?
Yes. There are three poems in this book that really jump out to me, and that's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's funny. I think I'm beginning to see a pattern in my choices. This is a very short poem by one of my most favorite poets, Lucille Clifton. She was an American poet. And this is Blessing the Boats at St. Mary's. May the tide that is entering even now the lip of our understanding carry you out beyond the face of fear. May you kiss the wind, then turn from it, certain that it will love your back. May you open your eyes to water, water waving forever, and may you in your innocence sail through this to that. Simple poem from Blessing the Boats, which I think won the National Book Award.
Simple, and that I feel that I would need to reread it and let it sink in.
Mm.
I mean, like, you know, the best of poems, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it mean to you?
I think it is a blessing of a poem. I think that Lucille Clifton is a fellow female poet. I really looked up to her, and I went once to a conference. She had just passed away, and her daughters were there, and they talked about her. And there was one, this has just always stayed with me. So she went when she was such a well-known poet, she dined with the Clintons during their presidency. And the next day, they were evicted from their home. And, you know, she had, I think, 5 children and, you know, her husband. It makes me wonder, you know, in what kind of country can you dine with the president? And, you know, you're that well-known a poet. And the next day you're evicted. I think her ability that she could still write poems and raise 5 children and have these financial hardships. And, you know, ultimately they ended up moving to California and she became a professor out there. But it was not always easy for them. And I think I take a lot of inspiration from that. This poem, I feel like it's a blessing from her. It's kind of how we would bless the boats, right? It's the title poem of the book. Hope you have a good voyage from here to there is really what it's saying. And during hard times, I think if you simplify, that's really what we hope for.
So it sounds like, you know, from your first poem, you were saying that you became dedicated to living a life close to poetry, writing and everything, and that this poem sort of sees you through difficult moments in that journey. So what would you say is the thing that keeps you dedicated to it after all these years?
Oh, I think the fact that it still works for me. I still discover new things about life, about myself, about humanity, about the people I love, about the world I love from reading poems. And you sort of find it one detail at a time. You can be surprised by poetry. I think that's what I love about it. The last poem I have to read is by Mary Oliver. It comes from her book, White Pine. I'll say why I picked this poem after. This is May, and it's a prose poem. May, what lay on the road was no mere handful of snake. It was the copperhead, at last, golden under the street lamp. I hope to see everything in this world before I die. I knelt on the road and stared. Its head was wedge-shaped and fell back to the unexpected slimness of a neck. The body itself was thick, tense, electric. Clearly this wasn't a black snake looking down from the limbs of a tree, or a green snake, or the garter, whizzing over the rocks. Where these had, oh, such shyness, this one had none. When I moved a little, it turned and clamped its eyes on mine. Then it jerked toward me. I jumped back and watched it flow on across the road and down into the dark. My heart was pounding. I stood a while, listening to the small sounds of the woods and looking at the stars. After excitement, we are so restful. When the thumb of fear lifts, we are so alive. So I picked this poem because years ago, I read it, And I remembered the line, I hope to see everything in this world before I die. And I kept that line for so long, but for whatever reason, I have so many Mary Oliver books, I was able to find that poem again, or find the line from the poem. Couldn't figure out which one it came from. But but that line just stayed with me. And then just cleaning, arranging of so many months ago, I found it again. And I was like, there it is. I began to think I made this line up, you know, and Mary Oliver's hard to, her estate is very strict about putting poems online. And so you can't just Google her. I mean, you can, but you can't just find a line that you've lost. So yeah, that's why I picked it.
Just from hearing that for the first time, that line kind of seems to stand apart or just be a statement in the midst of the whole thing. Do you think that it encapsulates the meaning that you take from the poem?
I think it does. I think that that line itself could really express how I view this world. You know, I want to experience and see and taste as much as I can before I leave it. And I think that this is an encounter that a lot of people would react to and leave it on the fear. You know, but she gets past the fear and comes to some kind of understanding that it's this kind of fear that makes us feel alive. Yeah, I think that, you know, when we hope to see everything, right, that really means everything, not just the good stuff. And I think that's what's interesting about this poem.
The shock of the snake, there's something really primordial about that.
It really is. I mean, it's, I love that. It's just, I mean, the poem really emphasizes this is not your average garter snake. This isn't just a, you know, this one means business.
This week on Poetry on the Radio, to mark our one-year anniversary of broadcasts, we, co-hosts Peter Soles and Kimberly K. Williams, and I, Peter Monahan, producer, are talking about how we all came to be interested in poetry, what moves us to produce poetry on the radio each week. Co-host Peter Soles read next.
So my choices, I think that they kind of tell a story, because my appreciation of poetry is really just sort of recently began. I'm studying creative writing at uni, and that's really what brought me to poetry and made me realize that I love it for the first time. So I feel like the poems that I've chosen have been the ones that sort of came to me and showed me what poetry can do and excited my interest. But I still feel like there's just so much that I need to explore still, of course. So the first one I'm going to read, it actually was one that we looked at in class, and it's by Edwin Morgan. The poem is called Opening the Cage, 14 Variations on 14 Words. And it starts with a quote from John Cage, which says, I have nothing to say, and I am saying it, and that is poetry. And the 14 variations are, I have to say poetry, and is that nothing, and am I saying it? I am, and I have poetry to say, and is that nothing, saying it? I am nothing, and I have poetry to say, and that is saying it. I that am saying poetry have nothing, and it is I, and to say. And I say that I am to have poetry, and saying it is nothing. I am poetry and nothing, and saying it is to say that I have. I have nothing is poetry, and I am saying that, and I say it. Poetry is saying I have nothing and I am to say that and it. Saying nothing, I am poetry and I have to say that and it is. It is and I am and I have poetry saying, say that to nothing. It is saying poetry to nothing and I say I have and am that. Poetry is saying I have it and I am nothing and to say that. And that nothing is poetry, I am saying and I have to say it. Saying poetry is nothing, and to that I say I am, and have it.
Love it. That's not an easy poem to read.
Not at all. Yeah, so I think what excited me about that poem is that obviously it's a joke, in a way, but it also seems completely serious.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously taking that quote and running with it is just, it's a funny quote to begin with. It sort of sounds like it's having a dig at, you know, what poetry is. But then when you experiment like that and you throw words out there and you find all these new iterations, there's all these surprising little lines in there, new meanings that are coming out and new rhythms. And yeah, so it's sort of just like a really good retort to that initial statement. The way I take it changed a bit because when I actually read the whole quote from John Cage, it's, "I have nothing to say and I am saying it, and that is poetry as I need it." And just with those last few words, it sort of does sound a lot less like John Cage is trying to have a dig at poets and poetry. But still, it's almost better when you just leave that out. And I suppose that's the decision that he made.
It's a wonderful example. I mean, you've said in your introduction that what you've had fun doing is exploring what poetry can do. And this is almost meta in that idea, right? It's doing and sort of contemplating all at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I kind of love as well the title, Opening the Cage. Because for me, that's what poems like this feel like, is like saying poetry is a space where you can break rules, you can experiment, and that is exciting, and that's what keeps me interested in poetry.
It's funny that he responds to Cage with a poem that uses sort of some of the Cagean sort of methods of repetition and where the permutations cast light on something you're not quite sure, and it's incremental and it's just odd, but it's effective rhetorically.
Very true. I have a feeling that John Cage would love the poem. I'm sure he did.
It makes me think of a quote that I think is attributed to William Stafford, though I've never been able to find the source of it, but it says, "Poetry can do what it can't say." And I think that's the perfect example. In contemplating how it can't say, it does.
Wow.
And it reaches.
Yeah, absolutely.
It goes to new places.
And the musicality of it is part of that, I presume, that the expression emerges from these arrangements of words that is quite counterintuitive in a sense, and not necessarily logical. This is expressive, but it comes out of some weird spaces in the poet's mind. And here you have a provocation by somebody who was sort of the quintessential questioner of a sort of rhetoric, of musical rhetoric.
So the next poem I chose, it's from Robert Bly, and it comes from a book of prose poems called What Have I Ever Lost by Dying? And I came across this book when I was at a 9-day meditation retreat. You know, it was run by a Buddhist center from Sydney. They have a library there, so you can read while you're not allowed to speak. So people, you know, in their free time often just pick books from the shelf. And this one was the one that stood out because I didn't initially see what it had to do with Buddhism, whereas the others are largely, you know, very directly related to Buddhist practice and everything. But it starts with a quote from Rumi, and that kind of gave it away for me, because pretty much every meditation session we were doing at that retreat would start with a poem from Rumi. And so I'll just read that little bit from Rumi at the beginning of the book. It says, "I lived for hundreds of thousands of years as a mineral, and then I died and was reborn as a plant. I lived for hundreds of thousands of years as a plant, and then I died and was reborn as an animal. I lived for hundreds of thousands of years as an animal, and then I died and was reborn as a human being. What have I ever lost by dying?" So obviously that pretty directly relates it to the Buddhist beliefs. But beyond that, you know, I just found it was really the perfect book to delve into, or that poetry in particular was the perfect thing to delve into in that environment. So the poem I chose is called Welcoming a Child in the Limantour Dunes, for Micah. Thinking of a child soon to be born, I hunch down among friendly sand grains. The sand grains love a worried man. They love whatever lives without force. A young girl who looks out over her life, alone, with no map, no horse, a white dress on. The sand grains love whatever is not rushing blindly forward. The mole blinking at the door of his crumbly mole Vatican. And the salmon far out at sea that senses in its gills the Oregon waters crashing down. Something loves even this planet, abandoned here at the edge of the galaxy, and loves this child who floats inside the Pacific of the womb, near the walls, feeling the breakers roaring.
And that whole book, it's a small book, right? But why that poem?
Well, I think probably the line that initially sort of grabbed me is this line, the sand grains love a worried man, because that really spoke to me. I think I'm probably not alone in feeling that when you contemplate the vastness of the universe, it's so reassuring, because you can just let go of anything that you think is important and worrying about. It's so comforting. And that idea, I just think the whole poem to me is about that. And I read there's a little sort of essay at the back of the book where Robert Bly is talking about different approaches to the prose poem. And he talks about his style as being part of the tradition of the object poem. And he says that his predecessor in this form is Francis Ponge. Robert Bly says that, you know, when you're writing a prose poem of the object poem type, that you're coming close to an object and participating in its complication. And I feel like that's what this poem is doing. And he's put a quote from Ponge, which says, "In these terms, one will surely understand what I consider to be the true function of poetry. It is to nourish the spirit of man by giving him the cosmos to suckle. We have only to lower our standards of dominating nature and to raise our standard for participating in it in order to make this reconciliation take place." And that comfort that I feel from those lines or from contemplating the vastness of nature, I feel like it is that idea of having the cosmos to suckle. It's giving you a piece. And in this poem, Waiting for a Child to be Born, I feel like there's a worry there about the kind of world that this new human will live in, but at least they will have the same sources of nourishment and reassurance that we all have. So I just think that's beautiful.
Mm. I can see how it's all connected, the Rumi quote and the choice of that particular poem, right? This idea that one thing becomes another, and the way that something is simple, in quotation marks, is sand, right? And how it becomes much more complicated. That I think the part you read at the end explains that really well. It's really neat. Robert Bly is absolutely, for me, I mean, he was probably the greatest ambassador of poetry of the 20th century. And so it's just so cool that you were in Sydney, right? And you found this book by this American poet.
Yeah.
And you couldn't even talk.
Couldn't talk. And I accidentally, I swear it was accidentally, left the retreat with the book. I was supposed to, it belongs there. I will one day return it. I feel really bad about it.
No. It's meant to be with you for a while.
Next week on Poetry on the Radio, we'll continue this anniversary feature where we program producers are talking about how we came to be interested in poetry. I'm Peter Monahan. Poetry on the Radio is produced each week here in the studios of Art Sound FM on unceded traditional lands in Canberra. Program co-hosts are Peter Searles and Kimberly K. Williams, who produce the program with me, Peter Monahan. Poetry on the Radio is heard Sundays at 4:30 and again Mondays at 10:30 p.m. on ArtSound FM.